Good afternoon to everyone gathered, our small crowd here. We are glad to see you today. We're hearing one case today. It is appeal number 23-3418. Good afternoon, Judge Hamilton, there on the screen.
Good afternoon. I trust everybody can hear me.
This is Wilson versus AIM Specialty Health. Can we increase Judge Hamilton's volume, please? All right, can we just do a volume check again, Judge Hamilton?
Sure, I'm about to ask a penetrating question.
Okay. All right, we can hear it and we'll look forward to that. So Mr. Ellis, you know what you're walking into. We welcome you to the podium.
Just kidding, that's just the test.
Please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Ellis on behalf of Ms. Wilson. Ms. Wilson languished in the same role under the same manager, Opozinski, for nearly a decade while her colleagues of comparable experience, who were not black, were paid more than her and promoted more often than her. She languished, they flourished. And in fact, it was not until after she filed her EEOC charge and after Opozinski was replaced with Snow, a black superior, that Ms. Wilson finally began receiving the pay and promotion that actually reflected the value and qualification of her work as an employee. Nevertheless, the trial court entered summary judgment on both theories of liability, failure to promote, and disparate compensation. We respectfully request that this court reverse for the following three reasons. First, the trial court erroneously narrowed its view of the evidence to events that occurred within the statute of limitations period, ignoring anything that happened before April 2017. And second, the trial court applied an artificially high sole causation standard to both theories of liability. No such standard exists. In fact, it would have been reversible error if the trial court applied a but-for causation standard, as though this were an age discrimination claim, but it is not. And yet the trial court applied a sole causation standard. So we're two levels removed of what should have been applied. And the third reason is that as a result of those first two more legal errors, the trial court erroneously granted summary judgment on the pretext prong. Had the trial court not made the first two errors, we believe that Ms. Wilson would have withstood summary judgment because she presented enough evidence on pretext for a jury to find a fair inference of discrimination, which is all that is required under Ortiz. And so for those three reasons, we think that the trial court made a reversible error. Now, getting to the first reason, the district court erroneously narrowing its view of the evidence to post-2017 events. Under Kellogg, this court's decision from 2021, when there is a discriminatory act that happens before the statute of limitations, a plaintiff such as Ms. Wilson can nevertheless rely on that prior act as evidence to color the acts for which she can recover.
Looking at Ms. Sankara specifically, did the district court ever hold that it was excluding Sankara because that evidence fell before the April 2017 date? Or is just that your theory? And I'm asking because we took a look, of course, at the summary judgment briefing. Is it possible that the district court excluded Ms. Sankara as comparative evidence because that's missing in your summary judgment briefing? You refer to Ms. Sankara in your facts section, but there's no analysis when you were doing summary judgment about Ms. Sankara as a comparator. So that's a two-part question.
Sure. First, the trial court did not expressly ignore Sankara, but it effectively ignored her when it ruled correctly on the statute of limitations issue. But then, even though Ms. Wilson and AIM identified Sankara as the primary comparator on which Ms. Wilson was going to rely in the summary judgment motion practice, the only argument that AIM raised, and this is clear from the briefing on the motion practice below, as to Sankara was simply statute of limitations. And so Ms. Wilson responded with reliance on this court's precedent I believe, a 2011 case titled Laziv.
I guess where she was trying to go here is trying to figure out Sankara was used. There's two claims. There's two theories. Failure to promote, and then you have you paid less than.
Yes,
so for Sankara as a comparator, which theory are we wanting to apply her to or use her as similarly situated? You're wanting to use Sankara for both?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and so now going back to Judge Jackson Kumi's question, go ahead. So I just wanted to make sure that I understood how you're trying to use her.
I think the easier way to start is to identify the claims within the statute of limitations period, which then Ms. Wilson can rely on being passed over by Sankara as evidence on pretext on those. And in 2017, October
2017. I understand the theoretical basis for doing that and the legal basis under Kellogg. Can you point us to follow up again on Judge Jackson Akumi's question to where you highlighted Sankara in the summary judgment brief before the district court?
And so Sankara was highlighted in the joint statement of undisputed facts. Both parties agreed that it was, quote, that Ms. Wilson was primarily relying upon Sankara as a comparator. In response to that, it was AIM.
But I thought that was just in relation to the 2015 when Sankara was promoted from business analyst 2 to a business analyst 3.
Correct. But the inescapable fact is that the only argument AIM relied on that AIM made as to Sankara in the pre-2017 era is statute of limitations. It never argued that those decisions were non-discriminatory, and therefore
where did you argue that Sankara was a good comparator in your summary judgment brief? I think that's the third time we've asked, and you haven't yet answered it.
I don't have the exact record site in front of me, Judge Hamilton. I'd be happy to file a supplemental brief after the fact.
I am looking at your summary judgment brief, and I see comparators at pages 13 and 14 that do not mention Sankara. There's a footnote about her on page 5. There's a mention in page 2 in the facts, but I don't see any kind of effort to develop her as a comparator.
AIM never put her at issue as a comparator other than in the sense of the statute of limitations. And so it's our position that Ms. Wilson was not required to rebut an argument that AIM never raised. That is consistent with this court's precedent. And
I'm very familiar with that general principle of summary judgment practice, but you've got the burden of showing discrimination, and I don't see where you developed an argument that Sankara was a relevant comparator for any purpose.
Even if this court...
What did I miss?
We believe that identifying Sankara as a comparator in the joint statement of undisputed facts, in which both parties agreed that Ms. Wilson was primarily relying on her as a comparator, put it at issue, and then it was AIM who failed to raise the argument. And if this court believes that was insufficient to put Sankara as a comparator, there's still a secondary argument.
I think we're kind of maybe missing each other, because you've accepted that the court was correct in the ruling on the statute of limitations, that claims before 2017 were properly excluded under Section 1981 on the 4-year statute of limitations. So moving now to Judge Jackson Kumi's question, in 2017, a prima facie case that you have to be able to make that prima facie case, there has, comparators.
Right.
And so what the court is trying to ask is, what put the district court on notice that you were wanting to use Sankara as a comparator for those claims? Not their burden, but your burden for establishing that prima facie case of discrimination.
First, the identification to which both parties agreed when they filed the joint statement of material facts, identifying Sankara as someone that Ms. Wilson primarily relied upon. She's the first comparator. I think it's page or paragraph.
But a comparator to what? A comparator to failure, if that's...
On both theories of liability, Your Honor, because we can see that in 2015, excuse me, yes, in 2015, when Sankara was promoted, instead of Ms. Wilson, they were both BA2s, they both had comparable evaluations, they both had comparable experience at that time, it was Sankara that was promoted, not Ms. Wilson. And so that is both failure to promote and disparate compensation, because at that time, Sankara's base pay was higher in comparison to Ms. Wilson as well, even though they were both occupying the same position, had comparable qualifications. And so even if this court believes that the trial court wasn't sufficiently put on notice by the summary judgment motion practice, the trial court still applied an artificially high sole causation standard. That is not a standard that governs. In fact, Ms. Wilson was only required to prove or provide enough evidence that a jury could find AIM used her race as a mixed motivating factor. That is two levels removed from a sole causation standard on the failure to promote claim. And so even if, you know, I'm wrong on Sankara, that I don't understand how we can escape that legal error. I mean, that permeates the entirety of the analysis.
So we have that quotation, which obviously is incorrect. You're right. On page 21, were there other places where the district court signaled the wrong causation standard?
There were, and this is my mistake, because in the compensation claim, the district court judge used the phrase, a jury could not conclude that Wilson's race alone...
Can you tell us where you're reading from?
Yes, I'm sorry, page 17 of the order, and it's at the tail end of the disparate compensation claim analysis. Concluding, a jury could not conclude that Wilson's race alone, ellipses, was the source of compensation differences. So that's the trial court applying this sole causation standard to both theories of liability. I'm not sure.
You said on page 17?
Yes, Your Honor, of the order on appeal.
Okay.
Yep.
And the cited support for that is Ortiz, and Ortiz obviously stands for no such proposition. In fact, Ortiz could have us skip straight to the pretext analysis if AIM raises performance issues as a justification for the adverse employment actions, which it has. And so I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I would like to reserve the rest.
Very well, Mr. Ellis.
Could I just ask you?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your brief, you have a number of deposition quotations where apparently the plaintiff, you suggest, wasn't allowed to answer questions sufficiently. That's the sort of passage that's an effective response to a sham affidavit sort of argument. But what was the point?
The point was to get out in front of AIM's position below that in many ways Ms. Wilson may have acquiesced or accepted that her performance was the reason she was passed over for nearly a decade, and as opposed to, you know, her larger belief, as she told the VP of this company in a July 2019 email, that it was otherwise.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Ellis. Ms. Foley. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, Judge Hamilton, and may it please the court. I'd like to start by addressing Judge Hamilton's last question first. In that situation, the question was raised as to whether or not Ms. Wilson was able to sufficiently testify as to her fear of coming forward and raising concerns with the company. Contrary to what the appellant has stated in both the opening and reply brief, there is voluminous testimony in Ms. Wilson's deposition as to her concerns, as to attempts for her to talk with people about the concerns that she had that there was a racist culture. So to attempt to claim that she was cut off on those two instances, right before and right after those citations in the brief, she's talking about those specific types of concerns. And so I would argue that that was not something that should be, that was detrimental in the summary judgment decision, or that the court didn't, excuse me, that opposing counsel raises in his brief. To go back to the question as to the pre-2017, to address Your Honor's concerns, the cases upon which the Kellogg case, the Grosch case, that are this marker in time on the 2017 issue, those were specific events, either a comment in the Kellogg case or a policy in the Grosch case, that then set up the plaintiff or plaintiffs in the second case for a lingering impact on the pay that they were not able to receive. There is not a comment in this record, and there is not a policy or a practice in this record that would suggest that it was appropriate for the district court to go back and consider Ms. Sankara or her her abilities and her performance as compared to Ms. Wilson stretching back to 2015. The court appropriately found that events that occurred prior to April of 2017 was that line in the sand, and where the court should, or and where the district court properly concluded that we move forward from there.
Did the district court make that finding expressly? I'm not going to consider anything? That would be hard to reconcile with Kellogg.
Well, the district court said that in looking at the 1981 four-year statute of limitations, that it was appropriate to go back only to the April, I believe it was April 12th, 2017.
Which is clearly correct in applying the statute of limitations, but right. But we were asking Mr. Ellis the same sort of thing. Are we trying to tease out something that's implicit in the district court's opinion, or did the district court squarely address this?
First of all, the district court did not address Sankara. I agree with the court's concerns there. In fact, we would argue, and AIM has argued, that Ms. Wilson has since subsequently waived the ability to bring Sankara back into the picture here. Did the district court directly address Sankara? No. There were five different comparators that she looked at, two of whom were paid more than Ms. Wilson, and those are the two upon whom she focused in her decision to determine whether, either on the failure to promote or on the compensation claims. For Ms. Wilson to now attempt to pull in Ms. Sankara, to go back and pull her in, it's a question of waiver. She didn't raise her below. Yes, both parties got together and wrote 111 joint statements of fact. She was well aware that that was a person who could arguably been someone she wanted to address and bring up and ask the court to do some analysis on, but did not. And so it would be AIM's position that she has waived the ability to use Ms. Sankara as a comparator. And even if the court does go back and look at her, if you go back and look at Ms. Sankara's performance reviews from that 2015 time period vis-a-vis Ms. Wilson's, Ms. Sankara was excelling. She was doing phenomenal work. She had been, all of the comments in her performance review, which are at, I believe it's Exhibit Z to the Joint Statement of Facts, she was doing a very, very good job, appropriate to promote her at that time. Ms. Wilson, on the other hand, as to use opposing counsel's words, was languishing. In fact, the words that her managers used was struggling. When she returned back to the VA department in early 2013, after having been saved from a layoff, she came back and immediately began to struggle. She was not doing the work or the level of work that was needed to have her be considered for promotion. So we would argue both that they waived
again, that was 2013. And yes. So what ties the promotion of 2015 to the lack, and I'm sorry, promotion, I'm sorry, the lack of a promotion in April of 2017? Is there anything in the record tying those things together?
No. The next promotion at issue was really when Kimberly Lewis was promoted in October of 2017. And at that point, she had come into the department I think it was 6 or 7 months prior, and immediately, again, to go back and look at her performance review, hit the ground running. And so Ms. Lewis's performance vis-a-vis Ms. Wilson's performance was better.
But don't you think it's a little somewhat of a concern? I don't want to use the word stretch here to suggest that Ms. Lewis, who had BA1 experience and 3 months of contractor experience, was somehow much more valuable to AIM than someone doing in that job for almost 5 years?
I disagree. First of all, I believe that Ms. Lewis had, she had BA3 contractor experience when she was.
I said, yeah, for about, know, what, 3 or 6 months as a contractor?
It was about a year, I believe. I may be wrong on that specific.
That's
point.
Wrong. Okay. Uh-huh.
Apologies.
No, it's fine.
If you look, though, at the work that she did right when she came in, she immediately took over a team. She began.
But she came in making more than someone who had already been doing that job for years.
I don't know that it was, I haven't done any sort of statistical analysis. I don't believe it was a significant difference in pay. And that since, she did come in with, as the district court noted, she took a small pay cut. But she also, if you go back and look at the information in earlier in 2017, when the department was evaluating who was, you know, who were the top performers, who were the lower performers, Ms. Wilson makes a very, makes a point about the fact that Lewis was also in the bottom three. But if you look at those specific.
So when Lewis came in as a BA2 with no experience as a business analyst too, she came in at $75,000. And when Ms. Wilson came in as a BA2, she came in at $66,000. And she had 3 years of BA experience outside of AIM. And Ms. Lewis had 3.5 years of BA experience and 6 months of experience as a BA3 contractor.
Right. Yeah, and given the time differences as to when they came in and the methods in which AIM uses to set their salary ranges and you know, midpoints and all, I don't believe that that's any, the record evidence does not suggest that it was an intentional decision to pay Ms. Lewis more, or that Ms. Wilson's race was the cause of that particular decision. And so there's no evidence in the record to support that. And I think that would be an inference beyond what would be appropriate, both at summary judgment and here.
It's just a comparator question. That's really where I was wanting us to sit for a minute as
sure.
to how Ms. Lewis was a different comparator. Because at the time Ms. Lewis came in, we still have Ms. Wilson, who's been doing the job since 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time Ms. Lewis comes in, she has substantial more experience doing the job than Ms. Lewis, and Ms. Lewis still made more than her. And
yeah.
So the question that experience was the dividing line as to why she could not be used as a comparator. My question is, what in the record demonstrates that AIM valued that 6 month contractor experience over that of someone doing the job for the past 4 to 5 years?
Yeah. I think if to go back and look at how Ms. Wilson was performing over the point of time between 2012 and 2017, those reviews over the course of that number of years, all of which up until 2018 she agreed with, were did not show someone who was flourishing in her career. And her experiences vis-a-vis the others in the department was not as valuable, perhaps, to the company. That could be an explanation, a race-neutral explanation for why she did not increase at the
level. But
that's
not the reason that was offered. The reason that was offered was because of the 3.5 years of experience as a BA1 and 6 months as a BA3 contractor.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're offering different reasons.
That is not my intent to do that today. I believe that the district court properly found that those differences at the time were not race-based and were not the cause of the difference in her salary. And I think that takes me then to the next question, which was the sole causation standard that opposing counsel is suggesting. Ortiz talks about, excuse me, flipped my notes there. First of all, as a 1981 claim, it's supposed to be right here. Plaintiff's counsel suggested that it was a mixed motive standard that was to be applied. Is not. We believe that the sole, first of all, that a, in Ortiz, the court found that whether a prescribed factor caused the discharge or other employment action. Similarly, in recently, Judge Shaw in the Eaton versus Walmart case that we cited in our briefs was that the adverse action against the employee was because of their protected category.
Is there any doubt that a motivating factor, race being a motivating factor, is sufficient to violate Title VII?
No doubt.
Okay, so what do we do with the district court opinion that at the two money conclusions on each of the theories invokes a sole factor test, sole cause?
Your Honor, because the because this Illinois Department of Human Rights Act claims and the Title VII claims were primarily time barred, so to go back as far as the district court did to 2017 required her to invoke the 1981 causation standard and use that as the overlay in order to bring in as much of the underlying details that she did. And so sole cause, because of, those are, I mean.
Are you at least prepared to concede that sole causation is a different standard than but for?
Yes.
Causation.
Yes. But the cause is really, I mean, I think if we like were to diagram a sentence, we'd get to the verb of what was the reason, what was the cause, what prompted this to happen. And there is no evidence in the district court record or on appeal that suggests that it was Ms. Wilson's race that was the determinant.
Do you agree that the district court quoted and applied the wrong causation standard? Now, I understand if you're saying we win anyway, but let's start with that point.
I did not read the district court's decision in which she said that a jury could not conclude that Wilson didn't receive a promotion solely due to her race. I'm not sure I'm ready to embrace that as a sole causation standard, because the ultimate standard is, was her race the determinative factor? And there's no evidence in the record that it was because of her race or it was caused by her race. And I don't mean to mix those standards in any way, but the ultimate question.
Would you agree that if a district judge gave that as the jury instruction, we would have to reverse a defense verdict?
We would certainly argue that if that was the jury instruction that was provided, yes.
You'd agree that that would need to be reversed if there were a defense verdict on a sole causation instruction? Yeah, I agree.
So
we've got the wrong standard here. Why do you satisfy the correct standard?
Because the ultimate question for the jury is whether or not her race was the, and now I've lost my head.
Whether it made a difference, right?
Thank you. Right. Whether or not her race made a difference, there is no evidence of that. There is a lot of evidence in the record that suggests that it was her inability to, there were a couple of specific examples that the district court quoted, that it was, she struggled with timely getting reports in, she struggled with providing information that was concise and sufficient. There is evidence of that in the record, all of which is race neutral. And so there, for her to win, she would have to show that there was some indicia that those decisions were tainted by her race, and that has not been developed in the record, and it wasn't something that AIM considered when they were making those either promotion or pay decisions. I see my time is up. Thank you. Unless the court has any other questions.
No.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Foley. Mr. Ellis, you were asked a question just as you reserved, so we'll give you your full 3.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. May it please the court. Judge Pryor, you asked what ties the events from pre-2017 to post-2017, and Opozinski is what ties it. That's what ties Sankara and Lewis together, is the fact that Opozinski reigned over Ms. Wilson as her manager from November of 2014 to December of 2019. And it was not until Opozinski was replaced with Snow that Ms. Wilson finally received the promotion that she was due. And so we can look at Sankara in conjunction with those adverse employment actions.
We can't look at Sankara if you didn't raise it below.
Okay, I'll move on from that argument, Your Honor. But still, Opozinski somehow managed to hire just one out of 30 BAs in her time in that 5.5 year span. Only Snow was black. And so that statistic is damning. Not only that, Snow, when she took over for Opozinski in the managerial role, right after Ms. Wilson filed her EEOC charge, Snow explicitly refuted Opozinski's characterization of Ms. Wilson's work. And because she refuted that, she, within a year, promoted Ms. Wilson to the BA3 level. And not only that, but Snow explicitly testified that she believed Opozinski racially discriminated against Ms. Wilson on at least one occasion during that handoff period between Opozinski and Snow in the managerial role. Snow believed that Ms. Wilson was given an MSK assessment to Ms. Wilson on a racially discriminatory basis, because as it turned out, the justification for that assessment was completely fabricated. No one else actually received that assessment. It was just Ms. Wilson. And so when we're looking at Opozinski's reign over Ms. Wilson from November 2014 to 2019, that's why I filed the notice of supplemental authority for Vicchio. Similar situation there, sort of the inverse, where an employee was enjoying good, accurate performance ratings, and then once a new supervisor came in, they were fired within 9 months. And so this court reversed an order granting summary judgment on an age discrimination claim because a jury under Ortiz could look at that suspicious timing and determine that perhaps.
But now we're doing the exact same thing we did before. You presented this as you wanted to use the burden shifting framework. And now on appeal, you're asking us to look at it under Ortiz. You chose the path that you wanted to take. And so we kind of have to stay on that path for appellate purposes.
I will say that Ms. Wilson's, the very first section of the summary judgment motion, and this much I know is true, was a citation to Ortiz and that path.
Okay.
And so if...
Let me ask you to address AIM's review process for pay and for increase. I don't see you addressing that. How do Opozinski's actions establish that the reasons for Ms. Wilson's pay were lies or phony or pretext given AIM's or AIM's review process to determine pay and to determine promotions?
I think heavily based on the fact that Snow explicitly refuted the characterizations of Opozinski's past evaluations of Ms. Wilson's past work. And so I understand there's a temporal disconnect there, but heavy weight should be given to how as soon as Snow occupied the same vantage point that Opozinski had for 5.5 years, she had a very different understanding of Ms. Wilson's value as an employee to this company. And so a jury could look at that and determine that that was pretextual, or at least understand that Lewis was a valid comparator. And in 2008 in Warren versus Solo Cup, this court stated if there's a toss-up on whether a comparator is truly similarly situated, that's normally a jury question. And so to the extent that it is gray as to whether Lewis is a valid comparator, maybe that's for a jury to say.
But it's on the pretext question. That's where Judge Jackson Kumi was asking. You went back to
right, And so I think I'm blending the analysis as I see it under Ortiz, and I understand this court's hesitation to view it that way. But ultimately, we believe that even if it's just on the question of comparison.
Should she have given her poor evaluation simply because she didn't like her?
She might have.
Is that a 1981 violation?
No. But it would be
what
under the
was needed for this to get beyond Snow. Maybe she liked Ms. Wilson and Opekinsey did not like her.
Right.
What makes it a 1981 claim?
What makes it 1981 is that there can be several, you know, if we're not looking at mixed motivating factor and we're just looking at but-for, there can be several but-for causations, as Appellee has conceded. But-for my decision to open the courthouse door and then but-for my decision to go up the stairs, I wouldn't be standing here. But that's very different from sole cause. So I don't think we can extricate the ultimate legal analysis when we have that standard at play. And so we would respectfully request that this court reverse and remand, maybe for just an application of the facts based on good law, not bad law. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank the parties, and we will take the case under advisement. And so the court stands in recess.